that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates.
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman visited Seoul this week to meet with her South Korean counterparts to discuss North Korea, China, and other issues. She stressed what she sees as the two states' mutual concerns in remarks also aimed at Beijing.
Our two countries are bound together by our common security interests, by our economic ties, by our common values of democracy and freedom. We will continue to discuss regional challenges, including actions that run counter to the interests of the United States and the Republic of Korea and threaten to undermine the rules-based international orders.
South Korea has tried to balance its relations between China, now its largest trading partner, and the U.S., its security guarantor. And Seoul recognizes it needs the U.S. if it wants progress on peace with North Korea. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman once again voiced Washington's desire to bring North Korea to the negotiating table and its support for inter-Korean engagement, issues of primary importance to South Korean President Moon Jae-in. But Washington's support on those issues may come with strings attached, as the U.S. seeks its Asian allies' backing in its ongoing crisis with China. Joining the U.S. containment strategy against China might be costly for South Korea, say experts. Large demonstrations against the deployment of the American anti-missile defense system, THAAD, erupted when it was deployed in 2017. China then slapped South Korea with heavy economic sanctions over hosting the U.S. missile Shield.
It's a tragic history that powerful countries have used the Korean Peninsula as their battlefield. Preventing that history from repeating itself is most important for South Korea to avoid becoming entangled in a battle between the U.S. and China. It must firmly stake out a neutral position, even though it would cause friction with the U.S.
Sherman will next visit Mongolia and then China for just the second high-level meeting between American and Chinese officials since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Environment and energy ministers from the group of 20 rich nations have gathered in Italy's southern city of Naples for a two-day summit on environment, energy and climate change. The talks, chaired by Italy, which holds the rotating annual presidency of the G20, have reportedly been inconclusive so far, as officials are struggling to find common ground to put together joint statements on the topics being discussed. On Thursday, Naples saw a number of anti-G20 protests being staged in different parts of the city. In the morning, hundreds of protesters tried to break into the building where the meeting was taking place. Activists from the campaign group Avaaz, wearing masks depicting Argentinian soccer player Diego Armando Maradona, staged a protest calling for debt relief for developing countries.
People are sick and tired of being lied to. Once again, it looks like there will be a complete lack of any commitments and money. The richest countries are telling the poorest countries we need to protect the environment, and the poorest countries are saying we need money for that.
The largest anti-G20 rally was held on Thursday afternoon in the historic center of Naples. Thousands of people from all walks of life shouted slogans against corporate greed and the influence of governments, and in support of a counter G20 summit. Speaking at the G20 ministerial meeting, Italian Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani said everyone wants to be green without making the necessary sacrifices. The minister added that if the financial system won't change in favor of sustainable development, there will be catastrophic consequences for future generations.
The Naples G20 meeting is seen as a key intermediate stage ahead of global climate talks known as COP26, UN Climate Change Conference. The meeting is to be held in Glasgow, UK, in November. Max Civili, Rome.
We'll be right back. The long-awaited Olympic Games officially kicked off in Tokyo on Friday after a one-year postponement due to the coronavirus pandemic. The opening ceremony took place with no spectators in attendance and a reduced number of athletes joining the parade. Only fewer than 1,000 VIPs and officials were present at the Tokyo's National Stadium. The International Olympic Committee has banned foreign and domestic spectators for the first time in the history of the Olympic Games. Meanwhile, athletes, support staff, and media are subject to strict COVID-19 protocols. Most world leaders decided not to participate in the event. Also, top sponsors have stayed away, highlighting strong opposition to holding the event in COVID-fatigued Japan. Tokyo is battling a surge in coronavirus infections and is under emergency measures. Daily cases in Tokyo are currently at their highest in 6 months. The Japanese capital logged nearly 2,000 new daily infections before the official opening ceremony. Japanese officials have vowed to hold safe and secure games despite the lingering pandemic. However, a largely unvaccinated Japanese public is worried that the global gathering of 11,000 athletes could trigger a super spreader event. Earlier this week, the chief of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee said they are not ruling out canceling the games as more athletes pulled out after testing positive for COVID-19. So far, over 100 people linked to the games have tested positive for the virus. A survey by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper says around 70% of Japanese people believe that Olympic organizers are not able to contain coronavirus infections. For weeks, there have been calls for the already postponed games to be cancelled amid the rise of COVID-19 cases in Tokyo and elsewhere across the world. Hundreds of people gathered outside Tokyo's National Stadium ahead of the Olympic opening ceremony, while others demonstrated near the Tokyo government building to demand the cancellation of the event. However, the International Olympic Committee has rejected the idea of calling off the event. The committee could lose billions of dollars in broadcast rights if the games were cancelled. That could be a blatant example of choosing money over people's lives.
Every day, Inas gets on the boat with her younger siblings to help their family with herding their water buffaloes. To them, it's an everyday hobby to play with what they call black monsters, a hobby that is about to turn to ashes. Their bulky playmates are now dying of thirst in an unprecedented drought that has devastated the buffalo's habitat.
Every day we lose two or three of our buffaloes and sheep because there is no water, and this water over there is sour and polluted and is toxic to the animals.
This has been the case for thousands of residents in Iran's province of Khuzestan, who have for the past days been protesting over what they call mismanagement of water resources. Khuzestan is inhabited predominantly by Iranian Arab tribes who live on agriculture and animal farming, which have now been devastated by the worst drought in half a century. Heads of tribes have over the past days been acting as mediators between the protesters and authorities, asking the demonstrators to calm down while urging officials to solve the problems.
We lost our farms and livestock in the drought. We need our rivers and marshlands to be filled with water for our businesses to be up and running again.
Every day the scale of the disaster grows and we are paying the price. Our demand is legitimate. The authorities need to do something before an irreversible catastrophe takes place.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, stepped in and called on authorities to speed up their efforts to tackle the crisis. Over the past week, delegations from the government and other entities have been visiting the affected areas to review the situation. In one of its latest measures, the government opened the valves of Karkhe and Dez dams, which have partly filled the riverbeds.
Water is starting to trickle into the riverbeds, raising hopes that life will once again return to the dried land. However, residents here say the crisis is far from over, and authorities need to find a permanent solution to the issue. Yusuf Jalali from the outskirts of Bostan in the province of Khuzestan.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard.
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, groups of people would try to fabricate him or character assassinate him with all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him it's very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages.
The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice, in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
Thank you.
دانشگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهش من در جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The spotlight.
Tunisia is facing its worst crisis in a decade after President Kais Saied ousted the government and suspended parliament with the help of the army. Now, this was a move denounced as a coup by the main parties. Was the move by the president constitutional? Why would the president make such a move if he knew it would throw the country into a crisis? In this edition of the spotlight, we will look at where Tunisia is headed on whether the crisis is an economic crisis exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Clashes have erupted between supporters of Tunisian President Kais Saied and proponents of the ruling Ennahda party outside the parliament amid a months-long political crisis in the African nation. The rival rallies took place after Parliament Speaker Rashid Ghannouchi urged people to take to the streets. This followed Saied's Sunday decision to invoke the Constitution to dismiss Prime Minister Hesham Mashishi and freeze the Parliament for 30 days. The President, however, said the 30-day period could be extended if needed and that he would govern alongside a new Premier. Ghannouchi condemned the move as a coup.
Today we are surprised by supreme decisions that not only surprise Ennahda, but also surprise the Tunisian people and the world in a country that is proud of being the first Arab democracy and having the latest constitution, announcing decisions that are essentially a coup d'etat and is called nothing but a coup.
Ghannouchi also led a sit-in protest in front of the parliament after the army blocked him from entering the legislature building following the president's order. There were mixed reactions in Tunisia to Saied's decision.
Regarding this decision, it's the first time in my life I have heard a head of a state take a correct decision. We have taken back our country. This is the first time I have gone out to the streets to celebrate.
The decisions by President Kais Saied are not correct, against the constitution and the reality. They bring us back again to 1954. The scene of the parliament closed by tanks is very disgraceful.
The president and the Assembly of the Representatives of the People of Tunisia were elected in separate popular votes in 2019, while Mashishi took office last year. His fragile government lurched from crisis to crisis as it struggled to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and the need for urgent reforms amid its political disputes with Saied. Saied's move to dismiss the government and freeze parliament followed mass demonstrations in several Tunisian cities earlier on Sunday. The protesters demanded the government's removal amid a weeks-long spike in COVID cases and the devastating impact of the pandemic on the country's already ailing economy. However, the president's decision has posed the greatest challenge to the country since its 2011 revolution, which ousted longtime ruler Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Over the past decade, the country has faced a series of challenges, such as terrorism, which has choked the country's vital tourism sector and contributed to an economic decline.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the debate, of the spotlight, that is. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan joins us from London, Ontario. And we also have journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who joins us from London. All right, let me first turn to you, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, and ask you, what basically has happened here? I mean, obviously, this was not a spontaneous, I'm guessing, decision to have been made by the president. I mean, what did he do? Because this is kind of like a complete gutting of the country's main institutions, except for the military, of course.
Well, as we know, Tunisia's had 9 governments since the 2011 revolution. It's hardly been stable, but it is famed for being the only democracy to emerge from the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring. On the other hand, what we've seen is the usual corruption, poverty, unemployment, the very things which were supposed to have launched off the Arab Spring in Tunisia. Of course, that was the starting point with the immolation of a young man at that time, Mohamed Bouazizi, I believe his name was. But nothing has changed. Situation has got worse over the last year. Undoubtedly, COVID-19 has infected many Tunisians and severely damaged the economy, which is heavily dependent on Europe, to be honest. Its real GDP in that time contracted between 8.8% in 2020 after growing about 1% the year before. But due to the general decline in the economic activity and the hardening of financing conditions, it really created more and more inflation, more problems. So in all areas of the economy, production, for instance, fell in all sectors except agriculture and fishing, and generally a huge decline. This coupled with, of course, unemployment figures of around 17.5%, and rising, have put huge pressure on the public. So the public genuinely is upset with the government in place. The government itself is a kind of a mixture of the largest party, the Al-Nahda party, which is a Muslim Brotherhood offshoot, which has arguably performed pretty badly. But the president, at the core of this, is an individual who wasn't necessarily linked to any parties before. He was just part of a constitutional process, and he actually put together the constitution that Tunisia ran on after 2011. But gradually it seems that he's, as an independent person, with good links with the army and the security services in general, he's managed to get into a situation now where he can quite clearly tell these parties what to do. But the result has been a little chaotic, to say the least. So that's the backdrop. You know, what we're seeing, of course, rolling out, we can discuss as we go along in the program.
Well, Edward Corrigan, I mean, if we take the Mohsen Abbas in terms of the economic angle to this story, which has been reflected across the media as being one of the reasons, perhaps, for the country to go through the problems that it has and then perhaps to show itself. I'm guessing, I mean, I'm no analyst, but I'm guessing that this is not the way to go for the president to come out to oust the government, to suspend parliament with the help of the army, and also is planning to replace the defense ministers and the justice ministers. I don't think that's going to help the economy of a country, because we're seeing what the results are. I'm trying to get to the thinking that's gone on here of the president and what exactly is going on with his approach here.
Well, Tunisia has been in an economic and political crisis since at least 2019, and arguably much before that. You have, as the earlier speaker, you know, I think very correctly indicated, there's, you know, the economy's in a tailspin. They have a lot of problems with regard to the oil industry. The IMF and other financial institutions are putting the screws to Tunisia. And the tourism industry has been severely affected because ISIS has launched several terrorist attacks, which has scared away all the tourists. And that's sort of like another blow to the economy that they really can't afford. The younger generation is very angry. They're unemployed. They can't get jobs. Promises are made, but they're not kept. And of course, you've got the COVID crisis on top of this. You know, there's over 18,600 deaths. There's a fourth wave, and they have a shortage of vaccinations. But the Russians and the Chinese are stepping forward and sending, vaccines to Tunisia. But this is, I think that the president is an individual. He doesn't have a power base in the political parties in the country. And he does have, obviously, some ties to the military and security forces. But one commentator in the United States who's supposedly an expert said that the president has no power, he's got no ability, no plan, and he is just fires people, you know, which is kind of like Donald Trump's approach towards politics. It doesn't solve the problems. The Al-Huda Islamic Party is the largest party in the country. It has 64 seats, and it's been part of the government, but, you know, to take the largest party and prevent them from, you know, going to the parliament and exercising their lawful authority is very, very dangerous. But there is a split in Tunisia between sort of a more secular approach and then a more Islamic approach. So the Islamic parties are strong, and they are, you know, at a very serious conflict between the two visions of how, you know, Tunisia should be run. And of course, Tunisia was the first of the Arab Spring revolutions, and there was a great deal of hope for it because it did get rid of an autocratic leader, Ben Ali, and it, was hopeful, but it hasn't delivered on the promise. And that is now the frustration has come out. There's been, you know, mass demonstrations, you know, in support of the president, but also in support of the parliament, which has been dismissed. So it's very, very unstable, very dangerous, and unfortunately, there's no real solution to this. They have a 30-day window which to try to solve these problems, but unless there's a lot of goodwill from the president, from the prime minister, from the largest political party, and the speaker of this lower house, these people need to come together, and I don't see anything coming forward, and it looks like it's just an economic and political and secular religious mess.
Okay, well, mess indeed is what it looks like, at least for now. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, let's get down to the support factor here. Based on what is reported, the president is backed by the army, and it is said that he's actually an outsider. Tell us if you think that's true. And then, based on what has happened, the groups within that country are saying that this step is undemocratic. Some are saying that it's unconstitutional, and that includes the Ennahda. And in terms of, for example, the unconstitutional part of this whole thing, there is an Article 80, which I guess in his eyes was going to give him the power to do what he did. But it says that it requires consultation with the Prime Minister and the Parliament Speaker. Now, Ghannouchi, who is the Parliament Speaker, said that that did not happen. But who has the popular support here in terms of the groups, in terms of the president, and then in terms of the Tunisians themselves?
I think this is what makes this situation very volatile and very dangerous, because the president came into office with something like 70% of the vote. So he was clearly a popular president, and therefore he does have backing within the people of Tunisia. The people of Tunisia did overwhelmingly dislike the way that the Prime Minister Saeed has been running the affairs, of course. So this means that there is genuine discontent, and I think it is the case that the president has that general sense that he's different from all the others, and he might carry some hope for those people who are fed up with the existing power bases, as you were. So that's his legitimacy. He does have some street power. I think he does certainly have the army's confidence, and it may well be that the army is pushing this more and more. But I don't see it as he would have described, because using Article 80, being a professor of the constitutional itself, or a constitutional professor, law professor rather, he cited extraordinary measures to deal with what is thought of as an imminent threat to the country. Now, the imminent threat that he was indicating was this kind of failure to deal with the coronavirus. And then, too, he has a point, because the shortage of supplies, and only 7% of the population out of 11.7 million people have been fully vaccinated. So clearly a large number of people haven't had the vaccine. The coronavirus itself reached a record of about 324 hours of a period recently. And, it's got the highest per capita death rate, or one of the highest per capita death rates in the world, perhaps even the highest, I'm not sure exactly, but it certainly is amongst the top in that respect. So there were huge problems around the coronavirus issue, without a doubt. But going more widely, I don't think it's a really sincere effort that he's made to prevent that imminent threat that he's put forward. But nor is it a well-planned coup to take power in the traditional sense of a coup. I mean, he's not fully tried to dispose of the parties yet. He hasn't used the army to slam down all the institutions. In fact, the Interior Ministry didn't listen to him when he gave certain orders straight after the takeover, if you like. And he was defied. He put in his own presidential guard as the head of the Interior Ministry subsequently. And he's relying on that street support and the army to clumsily move forward. It's a poorly thought out, clumsy political ploy from what I can see. The other interesting thing is that the Egyptians, the United Arab Emirates, and the Saudis are all against him. They're hailing, they're for him, rather. They're hailing this as a victory against the Muslim Brotherhood. Traditionally, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't have the favor of the Saudis, etc. So there are interesting geopolitical plays that are going on here as well. He could, in the next instant, put the parliamentarians and the prime minister under house arrest. That could be an avenue he takes if the likes of Mr. Ghannouchi, the head of the Al-Nahda party, etc., don't listen to him. And that creates the volatility on the streets. It would mean perhaps those parties would mobilize on the streets and even more violence and even more trouble could ensue. It really, there are solutions which might entail outsiders who have influence, certainly the Europeans have influence, getting involved in negotiating some sort of peace here.
Okay, well, Edward Corrigan, if we talk about outside influence, tell us what you think, whether it's in the form of the UAE and Saudi Arabia, who do not like the Muslim Brotherhood. In the case of Ennahda, that would apply in some respects. And then you also have the European Union, perhaps, in the form of maybe France coming into the picture, or maybe just as a whole, trying to see how it could influence the events that are unfolding there. Do you see any of these happening?
Well, they're all happening. That's the problem. The Saudis have a very, Islamic approach towards politics and to support their own dictatorship and authoritarian rule. Same with the United Arab Emirates, but they see the Muslim Brotherhood and any sort of Islamic party as a threat to their control, even though they use a lot of the same symbolism and points to support their own regimes. But I think that the president is really stretching the argument. Article 80 of the Constitution, it says it allows him to take exceptional measures in an imminent danger, and it has to be in consultation with the parliament and the prime minister. And these consultations haven't taken place. And, COVID is a serious problem, but I don't think it's an imminent danger that would really justify exceptional measures. So I think, Kais Saied is pushing the argument and trying to maybe deflect the economic and political problems and focusing on COVID, which a lot of it is not really the fault of, they haven't solved the problem, but I don't think you can blame the prime minister or the parliament for that because they just didn't have the vaccine. So there may be pressure from, Western powers in controlling the COVID vaccines and not giving them to Tunisia. And that's a way of putting pressure on the government and to help, cause problems and disturbances which other countries can take advantage of. Egypt is, does not like the Muslim Brotherhood, but the Islamic party, the Al-Huda, Al-Nuda party is the strongest party in the country. And, they have, obviously got a lot of political support. They're organized. But there is this, the younger generation doesn't accept their views and, wants a more secular approach towards politics. So this, it's really, badly divided. And, I don't see any real solution coming here. They're going to need a lot of money from somewhere. And unless the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates and other, people with deep pockets will step up to the plate and help the government. But France, of course, was the former colonial power in Tunisia. And, they are having their own problems right now with a very anti-Islamic movement where they have banned the hijab. And they have, there's a lot of problems in France. So I don't see the French and Macron going to be supporting, Islamic democracy in Tunisia. So it's a mess, and there's no solution. It's easy to say that there's no solution, but there isn't a solution. And the president was actually, he wrote the Constitution, so he's a constitutional law professor, and it gave him, there's a lot of hope to that, and I guess that helped him with his, winning the election. But he doesn't have, a political power base that is rooted in political parties or, sort of mass support, even though there is obviously some support. And a lot of people were happy to see the prime minister removed and also the parliament suspended. And actually all 64 lawmakers from the Al-Huda Islamic Party are ordered not to leave the country. So it's not quite house arrest, but they are being restricted. So anyways, as I said, it's a mess, and there's no solution on okay. the looking at before us right now.
Sure. Okay, well, let's go with the line, Seymour Sin Abbas, that you said, I believe that you said that this situation, to some degree, maybe to a large degree, if I understood you correctly, is a result of the poor economic performance of the country that's been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, after all, you had an 8% GDP drop for the last year, and the situation has not been steady in any shape or form since the uprising. Up to this point, there hasn't been really great economic factors coming out of the country. And this makes it fertile land for the terrorists to obviously penetrate into the ones who are out of jobs, et cetera. We know that's how Daesh terrorists and al-Qaeda spread their wings. Do you think that this is something that this road is the road that Tunisia is going to be going down on, given the fact that you have Tunisia that's marred by terrorists in one of those areas anyways?
You certainly can't rule it out. You only have to look at Libya next door, virtually, and see what's gone on there. And the situation that's emerged there with Haftar and with all the kind of shenanigans that have gone on, ISIS have been involved. You've got all sorts of abilities of mercenary forces. Turkey got involved in Libya. The French were involved. The UAE and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, again, are involved there. So clearly all of these foreign powers do have interests, and we all know that ISIS is actually a mercenary tool for Western forces, and quite often is used as a way of either creating chaos or getting certain folk to relinquish power. It's going to be interesting to see how it pans out. Certainly, you know, nobody wants another refugee sort of crisis with of course enough refugees passing through Libya into Europe. Europe certainly doesn't want another exodus via Tunisia. So they've got a lot of interest in trying to keep stability here in Tunisia. They've got, of course, the rise of the Islamic State, which happened because of the Arab Spring, which is also on their plate. And those forces are wandering around in the places like Tunisia, looking for opportunities. And whoever's backing them might decide it's time to have a piece of action there as well. But the only hope is really, I think the Europeans probably stand the best chance with their established roots and links in trying to renew a national dialogue. They did this in 2014 with some success, and to try and draw a roadmap out of the current sort of constitutional crisis, and perhaps to get special committees to take charge of the COVID response and actually get the vaccines to Tunisia, make it an emergency case, if you like. They could also certainly get involved in securing economic support. The Europeans could put forward an economic plan, but that would mean the increased neoliberalization and the control of Tunisia by the World Bank, by those same old institutions. And who knows, for some of us who are real cynics, it could even be that this is exactly what's required. Perhaps, the Ennahda party wasn't quite being able to do what the powers that be wanted them, and this might be a way of shaking them up to try and threaten them and to actually sort of perhaps even take over through dictatorial means. It wouldn't be the first time. They did it in Egypt with Sisi. Libya has the same sort of scenario, and of course Tunisia could be another along the lines. I don't think it'll get to that, but certainly at the moment it looks awfully dangerous and awfully volatile, and as my colleague said, it's very hard to see a way out immediately without some major money power being involved to persuade parties to go the direction of peace.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guest, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan. Many thanks. And journalist and political commentator Seyed Mohsen Abbas there from London. From Mika Wittaf, my entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini's testament. In today's program, we're going to discuss another part of the Imam's testament, where he exposes the enemy's plots for forging rift between universities and seminaries. Please stay with us. Seminaries have a long history in Iran, while modern universities are considered new institutions, although the older form of academic education dates back to over 1,000 years in Iran. This is proved by the Jundi Shapur University in Khuzestan province, which dates back to the Sassanid era. The first modern university was founded in Iran in 1934, and by the name of Tehran University. However, seminaries date back to the first Islamic centuries. Seminaries have shouldered the responsibility of educating Iranian teenagers and young people before the entry of university to the country. As a result of Western propaganda, seminaries are considered as a center of religious teaching with no link to rationality and rational education. But with the entry of faithful and devoted students into universities in the 1950s, gradually there emerged congruity and convergence between these two educational institutions. Alongside the formation and reinforcement of the despotic climate in the country and further assistance between university and seminary students, the political ruling system was more and more criticized by both centers. Imam Khomeini's high emphasis on necessity of cooperation between universities and seminaries broke the negative mentality among the members of the two centers and society at large. Furthermore, the presentation of new political and revolutionary ideas by him strengthened his base among academics. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, believed that unity between universities and seminaries would lead to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. After the triumph of the Islamic Revolution too, he considered this cooperation and unity very effective for the growth and bolstering of the Islamic Republic system of government. In view of this, he wrote in his testament, "Among the devilish schemes of the big colonial and imperial powers or exploitative powers that have been implemented for many years and has reached its climax since the era of Reza Khan and pursued by Muhammad Reza I, different ways is to isolate the clergy. In the era of Reza Khan, it was pursued through pressure, through suppression, defrocking, imprisonment, exile, disrespect, execution, and so on. And in the era of Muhammad Reza, it was pursued by scheme and other ways, one of which was forging hostility between academic and clergyman, which with propaganda was carried out in this field. Unfortunately, due to the unawareness of both strata about this devilish plot of superpowers, it yielded greatly. On the one hand, from schools to universities, it was trying to appoint the teachers, professors, and university chancellors from among Western-educated individuals, and those who were deviated from Islam and belonged to other religions, and the committed faithful were placed in a minority in order to train the effective stratum, which would take the rule in future, from childhood to adolescence up to youth, in a way that would hate religion in general and Islam in particular, and that they would hate clergymen. And at the same time, these were introduced by Britain and later on by the advocates of capitalism and feudalists and supporters of backwardness and opponents of civilization and sublimity. On the other hand, this wicked propaganda, they would frighten clergymen, promoters and devotees of universities and academics, and would accuse them of not respecting religion, promiscuity, and opposition to the symbols of Islam and religion. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, further wrote in his testament, "The result of those policies is that politicians and statesmen were opposed to religion, Islam and clergymen, and the faithful, whereas the masses of people who liked religion and clergymen were opposed to the government and the ruling system and whatever belonged to it. And the deep differences between the government and nation and academic and clergymen opened the way for looters to the extent that all affairs of the country were in their power and all reserves of the nation were poured into their pockets, so that you saw what happened and what was going to happen to this oppressed nation. Now, with the grace of God and the struggle of the nation, from clergymen to academics and to ordinary people, workers, farmers and other strata of society have torn up the chains of captivity and broken the dam of the power of superpowers, and rescued the country from them and their lackeys. My advice to the present and the future generation is that they should not neglect this history, and that the academics and the courageous young people and clergymen and students of Islamic sciences consolidate the bond of friendship as much as possible between the seminaries and the universities. And never be negligent of the plots and schemes and conspiracies of the deceitful enemy. And as soon as they see a person or persons who try with their words or deeds to sow differences between the seminary and the university, to guide and advise them. And if it is not effective, leave him alone and isolate him so that they do not let the conspiracy to take root."
Good morning.
Good morning.
beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.